Welcome back. My name is Duff Morton. I'm a doctoral student here. And I'm now in the funny position of introducing someone to whom SSA introduced me. And what a difficult position it is. I don't think anybody here envies the job of introducing a woman like Sharon Berlin at SSA. It will surprise no one to know that she's the Helen Ross Professor Emerita, the recipient of many awards, including the Richard Lodge Prize from Adelphi University School of Social Work and SSA's own Faculty Award for Excellence in Teaching. The author of many books, including Informing Practice Decisions, co-authored with Jean Marsh, and Clinical Social Work Practice, A Cognitive Integrative Perspective. Innumerable articles. She's been a faculty member at SSA since 1985, and before that served on the faculty at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Received her BA from the College of Idaho and a Master's of Social Work and a PhD in Social Welfare, both from the University of Washington. Is that all right? Okay, I didn't mess that part up. But that's the part that everyone knew anyway. And what I'd like to do is take a minute to explain why I'm here in this position. I asked the intuition of selfhood. I think Professor Berlin gives us the option of thinking with the self and with selves in a very broad way and in a way that allows us to enter into her thought process. She does this in a number of ways. First of all, she works quite extensively with the idea of multiple selves, which is a relief and a liberation for some of us who read her. But also, each of these selves, it seems to me, in her work appears as an object that's inextricable from a whole menagerie of other objects in the world, other people, things, conditions, ideas. And this inextricability gives her theory a particular breadth and a capacity for integrating other forms of thought. In the work of Professor Berlin, a cognitive intervention can be about getting food stamps. A cognitive intervention can mean organizing a neighborhood group to fight against the landlord. And that breadth of experience, that intellectual adventuresomeness, I think is not only unusual but important for all of us. That is, I think, perhaps what we really mean when we say that Professor Berlin is an integrative thinker. In fact, I found a quote from her. She gave in 1996, "I enjoy," she said, "the intellectual challenge of integrating theoretical materials and practical experiences. I especially enjoy interaction with students." And I think that quote meant something to me because it shows that integration is not merely a term for a particular kind of thinking about a technical issue. It's rather an approach to life more broadly. And I feel that her intellectual breadth and her capacity to assimilate a wide variety of conceptualization of selfhood has integrated me as a student and as one who is not friendly normally to this sort of thinking. And I want to finally mention the importance of hope in Professor Berlin's work. And I've been especially moved by the dialectic between acceptance and hope that's emerged in some of her more recent work. Because I think that the integrative cognitive approach, or the cognitive integrative approach, is one that allows us to have hope for the world. And after all, to use a phrase that she's quite fond of, it reminds us constantly that a mind can be changed, and that we can change our minds. So I wanted to conclude by offering a quote which I think of whenever I think of her work, and it's by a Brazilian musician, Raul Seixas. And the quote goes as follows. "When you dream, only you only have a dream. When we dream together, we have reality." So with that, I hope that you'll join me in welcoming someone who has helped us all to dream differently, Professor Sharon Berlin.
Thank you. Why did I ever leave? Incredible introduction. Very appreciative. Great to be back. I'm going to talk about the applied science approach and the cognitive integrative perspective. One of the things that I've always treasured about SSA is the fact that our intellectual leaders weren't inclined to take an either-or approach to knowledge building. Thanks to the likes of people like Bill Reed and Laura Epstein, and even our founding mother, Edith Abbott, It's never been a matter of theoretical versus empirical understanding or pragmatism versus empiricism. Instead, all of these approaches have been encompassed as vital. To paraphrase Bill Reed, clear theoretical conceptualization, commitments and values, and empirically derived data are interdependent contributors to a dynamic configuration of knowledge that is relevant for practice. In some ways, this perspective overlaps with the parameters of the applied science approach to developing knowledge for practice. As Teasdale and Barnard explain, the applied science approach to understanding mental and therapeutic processes is an iterative endeavor that takes a real-world problem or question as its starting point and then moves back and forth between theory, rigorous experimentation, and real-world application and evaluations to generate more detailed empirical information, improve theoretical accounts, and in the case that I want to consider with you today, advances in cognitive therapy interventions on the ground. So I'm here today to talk about some of the ways that I've drawn on and perhaps even contributed to advancements in applied science to revise Aaron Beck's model of cognitive therapy and develop a different version that I call the cognitive integrative perspective. The way that I've contributed to this applied science process has primarily been to critically examine, recast, and extend the work of others. I've pulled together research findings, conceptualizations, and practice guidelines developed by other scholars in the field and have added to them in developing a conceptual framework and therapeutic approach that takes into account a broader social work perspective that incorporates multiple therapeutic approaches, is based on plausible models of memory and the mind, and should be especially useful for clients whose mental health problems are intertwined with environmental stressors and barriers. In undertaking this project, my main method has been to read extensively and critically, to listen to respective scholars in the field, to think a lot about what all this information means for social work clients, to add my own ideas, and finally weave together a story that seemed plausible, practical, and had at least indirect empirical backing. Most of the evidence that I can marshal for various aspects of the cognitive integrative perspective comes from other people's research. Though I did conduct some studies of my own to test cognitive therapy interventions and to explore through task analysis how clients accomplish change within the structure of cognitive therapy. And I kept on testing out my emerging ideas more informally in teaching and in practice to see if they held up when I talked about them with students and when I tried to apply them with my own clients. I have to say that this whole process has been an incredible education for me. I've learned a huge amount from it. And of course, the process is not complete. In the short run, controlled empirical tests of the cognitive integrative perspective still need to be done, and this will be a critical step. Meanwhile, at least by some accounts, it turns out that taking knowledge that already exists, pulling it together, trying it out, filling in the gaps, and in essence making new knowledge out of it has a place in the applied science approach. When I first started thinking and writing about cognitive therapy as a doctoral student and a new assistant professor in the late 70s and early 80s, I relied heavily on the prevailing cognitive therapy approach of the time, and this was Aaron Beck's model of cognitive therapy for depression. Beck, who started writing about cognitive therapy in the early 1970s, distinguished himself from another early cognitive therapy pioneer, Albert Ellis, by making the point that the goal of cognitive therapy wasn't to help clients achieve rational thinking, but rather to help them develop a mindset that was adaptive, that allowed them the mental flexibility to respond to life situations in a functional way. Another major factor that favored Beck's model was that early on he subjected it to an empirical test. In a landmark paper reported in the first issue of the journal Cognitive Therapy and Research, Beck and his associates reported on a randomized experiment that showed significantly greater improvement for depressed cognitive therapy patients over pharmacotherapy patients. This early study was the first of many research efforts conducted by Beck and his group and then a host of others that served to evaluate and further develop cognitive therapy. Although cognitive therapy has not held the advantage in every empirical test, its cumulative record in treating problems of anxiety and depression is quite strong, especially when therapists are well trained and have a high level of expertise, and suggests that it's an approach that social work shouldn't ignore. The central idea underlying traditional cognitive therapy is that depressive emotions are prompted by negative thoughts, negative cognitions. In Beck's model, cognitions are understood as stream of consciousness or automatic thoughts that are within an individual's awareness. So these are thoughts that just seem to pop up unbidden without intention. Therapeutic action include a series of steps designed to help clients replace habitual negative thoughts with those that represent a fresh, unencumbered look at what is happening and what is possible. In typical accounts of cognitive therapy, the protocol usually starts the client off with self-monitoring to observe his or her automatic thoughts as they're occurring. Then, with the help of the practitioner, he or she learns to reflect on these thoughts, wonder about their necessity and utility, and ultimately to replace them with assessments that are more optimistic, that encourage adaptive behavior, and show compassion for trepidations and missteps. And often there's an additional step that includes looking for underlying themes that connect automatic thoughts, and considering whether these themes reflect deep-seated beliefs about how one needs to operate in order to be safe and acceptable in the world. Once clients have identified these beliefs, they're helped to reflect on whether they're the best guides for living one's current life. The other day I was in Title IX, a prominent women's sporting goods active wear store, picked up this shopping bag that is kind of a nutshell of cognitive therapy. It says, whether you think you can or you think you can't, you're right. So this is Beck's cognitive therapy in a nutshell or on a shopping bag. Title IX has very nice things.
I like it too.
So early on, Beck applied the concept of cognitive schema to these thematic meaning structures, suggesting that well-developed, stable, and relatively fixed patterns of thinking or schemas were at the root of depression and other mental health problems. Now, there's a lot to like about Beck's overall approach. We can't forget that it's been helpful to countless clients. And in addition, it's also been valuable in prompting therapy theorists of all stripes, including me, to look to findings generated by the cognitive and neurosciences and use this information in generating therapeutic accounts that have some basis in how the mind and brain work. Initially, I was drawn to cognitive therapy because it offered clear and logical guidelines for helping people let go of undermining internal dialogues. But as I became more familiar with it, I also found several ways in which traditional cognitive therapy seemed limiting. For one thing, the traditional cognitive therapy model maintains a fairly narrow focus on dysfunctional or distorted thoughts and gives little, if any, attention to the kinds of ongoing socio-structural deprivations and incursions that contribute to them. Given my social work background, my self-taught grounding in task-centered practice, and the research linking poverty, stress, and social isolation to increased rates of depression, I was quite certain that not only did difficult environmental conditions play a role in contributing to the development of dysfunctional cognitive schemas early in life and in activating them later on, as Beck suggested, but I also believe that current difficult circumstances were often implicated in keeping the depressive feelings going, extending them, and often making them worse. Beyond that, Beck's original model rested heavily on the view of the mind as primarily a repository of thoughts, and on the assumption that dysfunctional thoughts were the source of depressive emotions. But I knew, and my clients knew, that replacing negative thoughts with positive ones usually did not change ingrained emotional reactions. It's true that as cognitive therapy has evolved, Beck and other theorists associated with this model have become less inclined to argue that thoughts cause emotions. But even so, the primacy of word-based thoughts is still apparent in many contemporary applications. It's not as if negative thinking plays no role in contributing to depressive feelings, but the difficulty with putting so much emphasis on thoughts is that we commonly respond viscerally, emotionally, before we have an identifiable thought. And these feelings often persist even as we're repeating a variety of cheer up, lighten up, this will pass, you're not so bad, alternative thoughts in our minds. These limitations, along with significant knowledge developments in the social, cognitive, behavioral, and neurological sciences, started me on the path of searching for literature that addressed these and related cognitive therapy issues. An early series of laboratory investigations undertaken by Gordon Bauer and others in the 1980s constituted a significant step in addressing Beck's claims that emotional symptoms of depression are the consequences of negative cognitions. Bauer found that we access memories and attend to events that are congruent with our current mood. In other words, if we are in a low mood, we're more likely to access thoughts associated with that mood. In contrast to the cognitive therapy position, this body of work seemed to suggest that emotions play a key role in activating negative thinking. Bauer went on to incorporate findings regarding mood congruence into an associative network model of the mind to come up with an associated network theory of mood congruence. Versions of associative network models of learning and memory were widely subscribed by cognitive scientists in the 1980s and provided the basis for Beck's schema concept. Even though these models were often used to depict mind processes in general, they were originally developed, intended for explaining verbal learning and recall. As such, they describe how memory systems encode or translate external experiences into verbal symbols or thought fragments, which are then stored in networks of related thoughts. And there's fairly primitive slide that shows little thought fragments that are linked together by associative pathways. And in Bauer's model, there would be an emotion node in the middle there that sets off the thoughts. But this was sort of the way that people modeled memory. You have one thought, and that's related to another thought, and that's related to another thought, and probably all these thoughts reflect an underlying theme. And this is roughly how Beck depicted cognitive schemas. There have been numerous criticisms of this kind of word-based or semantic model of the mind. These criticisms argue that these models are too static, unidimensional, and slow to accurately depict mind processes. And eventually, these arguments, along with evidence that moderated Bauer's initial mood congruence findings, toppled his associative network model. So the search was on to find a way to portray the mind that could account for multiple kinds of memory units, not just thoughts, one that would adequately conceptualize the multi-level, dynamic, malleable patterns of neurological activity that are generated by the brain. John Teasdale, a British clinical psychologist who had been treating depressed patients and conducting research on mood biases in depression, started actively looking for such a framework. And he eventually found it in a conceptual model of memory called Interacting Cognitive Subsystems, ICS, that had been developed by Philip Barnard, a cognitive psychologist. And Teasdale has been able to use this model to provide a plausible and generative explanation of how at least some kinds of depressive disorders are activated, maintained, and resolved. In turn, I've incorporated key concepts from ICS into the core of the cognitive integrative perspective and have elaborated extensively on them. Here's a depiction of ICS. You might find the version in your packets a little easier to read. ICS is a cognitive model of memory that explains how multiple elements, multiple kinds of information active in memory, roughly the components of sensations, feelings, and thoughts, contribute to an integrated pattern that gives us a holistic feeling or an emotional understanding of what is going on. And so in the chart, this integrated pattern is referred to as the implicational subsystem. So they're the sensory subsystems, the visual subsystems that get organized at an intermediate level. Those feed into a propositional subsystem in which we are able to conceptualize what's happening, and all of the information finally gets integrated together into this overall feeling or overall sense of what is going on. ICS also provides a very useful depiction of how various feedback loops within the memory system can operate to keep the feeling going as one reacts with additional thoughts, body feelings, and behaviors to his or her own original reaction. So if you feel a sense of foreboding or a feeling of despair, that integrative pattern sends cues back to the body state subsystem and sends cues back to the propositional subsystem. So you can further conceptualize what you're feeling, your body further reacts to what you're feeling, and it sends more cues back to the integrative pattern. So there's a way that the mind can work to maintain depressive mood or whatever mood you're in. Because the component bits of information, or the memory codes, have been pulled together so many times, the information from the sensory subsystems and the body state subsystem and the propositional subsystem, because those cues have been pulled together so many times into an overall pattern, it's likely that even if only a few codes or subsystems are activated, the whole pattern and the response to it will be automatically synthesized anyway, even if only a few codes are present. There are a lot of technicalities and complexities in ICS but at the most basic level, it's organized around a few ideas. And I've already mentioned some of these, and so I think I won't review them here, but you can review them if you like in your packet. The science behind ICS consists of a wide range of investigations whose findings can be explained according to this framework. For example, ICS is able to provide an account of empirical evidence regarding mood congruence and incongruence. It's compatible with neuropsychological studies that track the multiple areas of the brain that take part in generating feelings and thoughts. It's consistent with findings from research on characteristics of low mood and depression, including the classic study conducted by Susan Nolan-Hoeksema and her colleagues, showing that people who respond to their depressed feelings by ruminating on their internal states are likely to extend these states. And most recently, Teasdale and colleagues have developed and tested a promising treatment model called mindfulness-based cognitive therapy for depression that is based on ICS formulations. Mindfulness-based cognitive therapy for depression is a psychoeducational model designed to prevent the recurrence of major depression by providing participants with training in mindfulness meditation and showing them how to use mindfulness to disengage from the interlocking feedback cycles that I just described, in which we react to our own depressive feelings by having additional thoughts and body reactions to it that in turn feed back to the overall feeling. So mindfulness meditation has been found to be a way to move consciousness away from that overall pattern and to open up the mind to other thoughts and feelings. A small handful of studies have shown that mindfulness-based cognitive therapy is effective in preventing relapse among study participants who had experienced three or more prior episodes of depression, but not for those who had only two prior episodes. The interesting point here is that the people in the three or more episode group were also more likely to report greater childhood adversity and earlier first depression onset than people in the two-episode group whose relapses were most often associated with significant life events. So far, the studies have compared mindfulness-based cognitive therapy with treatment as usual, seeking support from the family physician or other sources. But there is an investigation underway to compare mindfulness-based cognitive therapy with maintenance medication. And these results will help clarify the specific effectiveness of mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. Meanwhile, the finding that an exclusive focus on internal processes is not sufficient for preventing relapse among a subset of depressed people gives impetus to the efforts of social work clinicians to bring concrete services into therapeutic work and provides additional support to a main rationale underlying the cognitive integrative perspective. At first glance, the ICS system may look overly complicated, but when trying to understand the mind, a complex rendition is probably a good thing. And, of course, there is no requirement for clients to learn the ins and outs of these systems, and even clinicians will not necessarily need to master all of its technicalities in order to make good use of it. In my view, the beauty of ICS is that it provides a highly plausible and useful framework for understanding the fundamentals of the meaning-making process, and especially for locating various points within it where one might introduce change, and especially pardon me, it is based on good, although incomplete science, and it fits with clinical realities. It accounts for a whole range of information elements, not just word-based thoughts. It maps closely onto neuropsychological explanations. It incorporates processes of emotion and motivation, and explains why it's so difficult to change automatic patterns of meaning. It also suggests many inroads that one can take in order to try. In ICS and in the cognitive integrative perspective, change depends fundamentally on discrepancy and selection, or what I sometimes call options and attention. The discrepancy requirement means that the person has to encounter different kinds of information, information that's discrepant from what they already know. In other words, the sensory, body, and semantic cues coming into and generated by the system have to be different. For example, sunlight instead of clouds, expression of understanding from others instead of averted eyes and tight smiles, a rested, energized body instead of tension or heaviness, a call from an employer saying that your job has been reinstated instead of a layoff notice. In other words, the person has to encounter information options. And beyond that, the information needs to be selected into the system and given processing priority. So let's talk a moment about creating discrepancies. In developing guidelines about how to make discrepancies or new information available to clients, I've added to ICS conceptions by drawing from numerous therapeutic approaches, as well as the theoretical, empirical, and empirical literatures that bear on them. The next set of slides gives just a very quick overview of some of the options that one might pursue in order to generate new streams of information via different actions, thoughts, emotions, relationships, and life conditions. And I'm just going to whiz through these. We know from numerous sources that action is a powerful source of information. In fact, in 1996, a study conducted by Neil Jacobson and colleagues found that the behavioral components of cognitive therapy, such as graded task assignments, mastery and pleasure schedules, skills training, and general problem solving, were more effective ways of changing the way people think than treatments that explicitly attempt to alter thinking. This was a surprising finding for some people, but I wasn't especially surprised, because doing something new creates a variety of signals, a variety of cues that can be picked up by the mind or the memory system. Doing something new communicates commitment to ourselves and others. It can generate real-world positive consequences. It provides an internal sense of the self as a doer and an actor. Each new step that we successfully undertake increases our confidence that we can negotiate the next step. So action is a very powerful way to change thought patterns. As the slide indicates, there are two fundamental action strategies. One involves learning new skills, and the other involves doing something, and the other skill involves doing nothing. Involves learning to tolerate anxiety and other impulses, learning to experience them without acting on them, without doing things to avoid them. Of course, a key issue in all action strategies is that in order to gain action proficiency, one has to engage in the action repeatedly, which in turn requires persistence, which in turn requires emotionally compelling goals, at least small successes along the way, and the ability to attend to these improvements and let them mean something. which in turn requires carefully calibrated steps, at least a moderately responsive environment, and careful coaching and encouraging support from oneself, the practitioner, and others throughout the process. So in truth, it's impossible really to change one aspect of the memory system without involving the others. There are also numerous options for targeting thoughts, and many of those have been fully described in traditional cognitive therapy, so I don't want to linger too long here, except to say that for some people, figuring out how to step off the path of negative rumination, basically fussing in your head over and over and over about whatever, about how you've been understood, about how pathetic you are, about how pathetic they are, getting off of that mental pathway can be really important. We know that this kind of internal dialogue is not helpful. It's not problem solving. It doesn't generate new insights, but it does contribute to maintaining whatever miserable state you're already in. So various strategies for stepping back, for decentering, can be employed to interrupt this process. Another point that is worth mentioning here is that various forms of cognitive therapy have been criticized because they require some ability to reflect on one's own mental processes. Some people aren't very good at this, in part because they've had little opportunity to develop the skill, probably because as they were growing up, nobody was very interested in what they were thinking. So they didn't develop the habit of reflecting on their own thought processes, reflecting on their inner life, their thoughts or their feelings. According to Phonogy, when clients see that their circumstances have improved, the contrast between how they believe things had to be and how they are now open up a recognition that sometimes my thoughts don't tell me the whole story, and maybe I should think a little bit more about what I'm thinking and question my conclusions. This is an awareness that can be fostered and enhanced in a number of ways throughout the therapeutic interchange. So there may be opportunities to extend the people's capacity to reflect on their own internal processes, just as a part of the therapeutic interchange. So what about generating new information via emotions? In the last decade, a great deal of work has been accomplished in tracking the multiple parts of the brain involved in generating emotions. And this work has prompted more precise approaches for helping clients regulate their difficult emotions and build on their more positive, generative ones. Emotion theorists tell us that emotions are multi-component processes that unfold in phases. These phases are sometimes termed the low road and the high road. For example, given a situation of threat, threat cues are first picked up on the low road, specifically in the thalamus, and then relayed to the amygdala, which reads the danger pattern and broadcasts an emergency distress signal to other parts of the brain and body to activate expressive and physiological responses. In the second or high road phase, the same information is conveyed more slowly to the neocortex. At this point, we're able to feel the impact of incoming information in our bodies and draw on memory associations to conceptualize the situation. One of the clearest implications of this explanation is that the thinking brain can't really intervene in time to prevent the initial emotional response. On the other hand, just as soon as our high road awareness of cognitive and body reactions clicks on, it's possible to engage in conscious emotion regulation strategies to modify or modulate what happens next on the low road. Making use of our prefrontal cortex can make the difference in whether we extend our emotions and just let her rip, or use our awareness of our reactions as a signal for taking a breath, releasing body tension, accepting and riding out the wave of feelings, and perhaps coming at the situation again from a broader perspective. In this context, emotion regulation is not a matter of using our higher brains to block the emotion, which often has the paradoxical effect of intensifying or extending it. Instead, the idea is to acknowledge the feeling, create a working distance from it through observing, naming, and explaining it, and to calm the activation by accepting and allowing it, engaging in self-soothing activities such as deep breathing, relaxation, and showing compassion to the self. As several sources suggest, the best way to change a maladaptive emotion state is to replace it or transform it through a kind of synthesis with an alternative emotion. Perhaps finding feelings of anger to replace or transform fear, or allowing fear to give way to loneliness. Given Barbara Fredrickson's analysis of the attention broadening and resource building capacity of positive emotions, we can also encourage clients to generate, search for, and make the most of incipient positive feelings. And think about this. In order to change emotions, we might also want to change the situation that gives rise to them in the first place, which takes us to the next set of differences that we might want to introduce. And this is changing relationships and social situations. It's been clear to me, based on logic, experience, social work literature, and a smattering of empirical and theoretical accounts, that we're unlikely to make significant memory revisions and adjustments if our ongoing circumstances continue to supply us with the kinds of cues that fit well enough with the old memory pattern to add to them and keep them active. Even though one might expect that in the 40-plus years since Beck wrote his groundbreaking work, psychological scientists would have begun to more seriously explore the ways in which circumstances work to shape and constantly reshape the client's state of mind. Even so, empirical work on this question primarily comes from other sources. In giving us his perspective on this turn of events, Albert Bandura talks about how the discipline of psychology is proceeding down two divergent routes. One seeking to clarify basic mechanisms governing human functioning through a microanalysis of the inner workings of the mind, and the other centering on a macroanalysis of the influences of social factors in human development, adaptation, and change. But as he notes, we lack a theory that can bridge these two approaches. He says that we need a comprehensive theory that can merge the analytic dualism by integrating personal and social foci of causation within a unified causal structure to show how socio-structural influences operate through psychological mechanisms to produce behavioral effects. I can't claim or be sure that in the cognitive integrative perspective I've isolated the exact mechanisms through which socio-structural influences produce behavioral effects. But I do know from decades of social work research and scholarship that concrete changes in circumstances create big discrepancies, create big new important sources of information. If the client repeatedly encounters these kinds of discrepant informational cues, signaling that her life circumstances are different and better, there is the potential that she will or can be helped to attend to them, recognize their significance, take action based on them, and build new memories about them. This seems to me to be a fairly significant and, in my eyes, obvious step in merging the analytic dualism within a single causal structure. The next set of slides reflects some of the bare-bone options that are available to practitioners to create new streams of information about relationships and life circumstances. And I will just leave these to you to read on your own. I know I'm running over, but I'm almost finished. So what about the selection process? If new discrepant information is available, what can we do to increase the probabilities that the mind will grab onto it, that it will get selected into the system and it will be given processing priority? Teasdale and Barnard tell us that decisions about what competing streams of information to select are regulated by goals or by motivations. And in many instances that we're familiar with in clinical practice, these are survival-related goals or motivations that have been developed to protect against threats to one's vulnerabilities. Defensive goals, to minimize personal contacts in order to avoid humiliation, to achieve perfection in order to avoid abandonment and loneliness, to always be in control in order to avoid anxious freefall. When one encounters informational cues that signal threat, the system automatically recognizes the cues and gives them processing priority. Now, in his explanation of motivation, Klinger gives a sense of how this happens, and in the process he clarifies the intimate links between motivation and emotion. As he describes, cues related to significant goals immediately activate a proto-emotional alarm in the limbic system of the brain. This would be a low-road process that we learned about when we were discussing emotions. This rapid, non-conscious, general alarm automatically tunes the system into whatever is happening and then activates other expressive, cognitive, and motor processes. In order for new discrepant information to be noticed and processed, old defensive goals need to be disengaged and new forward-looking ones need to be radically strengthened so that they can keep us alert to opportunities for opening up, lightening up, and making things better. The issues here are the same as in emotion regulation because emotion regulation and motivation regulation is essentially the same process. We feel emotion when something is online that is relevant to our fundamental goals or motivations. In these situations, we can't really help ourselves from experiencing an initial goal-related emotional reaction. But once we have awareness, we can recognize the old responses for what they are and open the mind so that it can create or notice new sources of information and create new mental states. The other side of motivation work includes developing and strengthening goals that will alert us to opportunities to improve our situations and ourselves. In thinking about how to do this, I've drawn from numerous sources in the social work and social psychological literature that shed light on the kinds of goals and goal achievement strategies that are most likely to lead to positive outcomes. In particular, I've borrowed from Reed and Epstein, and from Marcus and Narias' work on possible selves, to lay out a set of steps for helping clients develop positive goals, or in Marcus and Narias' terms, positive possible self-memories. As they explain, in order for memory representations of hoped-for selves to gain traction, they have to be feasible, accessible, filled with specific, vivid, and emotionally compelling detail. By anticipating desired outcomes, planning steps to take to accomplish them, conducting mental simulations of how the actions will unfold, and practicing them in real life, one lays down and strengthens memory representations of the details of an emerging self and creates a stronger emotional alarm signal that will alert us to opportunities to further develop that emerging new self. So it's time to wrap up, past time. But before we do, what about this shopping bag? Does thinking really make it so? I wish it did. It depends. It really depends. It depends on what other external and internal streams of information that these thoughts are competing with. If the thinker is operating according to readily accessible, emotionally charged, defensive memories about laying low to avoid disparagement or even abandonment, if she has very little experience in standing up for herself, if she's in an environment that remains highly critical, then the chances are pretty slim. And here is where the cognitive integrative perspective can help. It gives us ways to generate new social and personal streams of information and to help help people develop the attentional flexibility to notice these differences, the cognitive and emotional capacity to conceptualize and feel their significance, and the skills to act on them, to make the most of them. This is a very brief version of the overall approach, and I've come to it through prolonged and careful reading of theoretical and empirical literature, through my own empirical work, my social work teaching and practice, and the ideas that all of this have generated. And I like to think that this work falls within the balanced perspective. That's the legacy of our beloved SSA predecessors, and that it has a place on the long and winding road of applied science. Thank you. A question or two? Do we have time? It's not really been tested. I would be very grateful. I'd be very happy if someone would step forward. I think one of the tests would be a comparison of traditional cognitive therapy and a cognitive therapy that put more emphasis on altering real life situations of clients. And it would be a very nice test. It's waiting to be done. You know, I kind of ran out of time. But I'm hopeful that other people will step forward and conduct that comparison. And in my own work, I did do some work as I was developing the model. The task analysis that I did of cognitive therapy showed that people who had serious real-life difficulties going on, economic stress, marital stress, worries over jobs, had a harder time with the traditional cognitive model than people who weren't up against those kinds of barriers. And that's one of the factors that led me to sort of develop this model. So there was reason. I had empirical data to kind of support the development of the model, but it's really not been tested. All right.